Now I would like to introduce our main speaker for this evening,
Mike O.
from San Diego.
Yeah. My name's Mike, alcoholic.
Something that doesn't look right about this right off the bat, man. These things are way too low and I'm too tall. I don't know if there's any adjustment. Doesn't matter. Anyway, my name is Mike, and I'm an alcoholic, and I want to thank Larry for asking me to come out here and share my story, and I want to welcome all the new people to Alcoholics Anonymous, any visitors or anybody here for the last time or last meeting, anything like that, I want to welcome you as well. I really believe for myself that I owe my entire sobriety, I mean, I really believe this way deep down inside, to not drinking and the power that I found through taking the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because without Alcoholics Anonymous and the power greater than myself and a lot of good, supportive people in AA, there's no way a guy like me could be sober for any period of time, let alone as long as I've been sober. My sobriety date is June 24th, 1985. And I haven't found it necessary to take a drink since that day. And I never want to drink again as long as I live, and that's the truth. The problem with that is, in my particular case, I'm not so sure I won't. And so I'm going to share with you a little bit about what I was like before I ever took my first drink, because I think it has some relevance on my alcoholism. I grew up... And I want to thank Tasha, and before I forget, because I am a little self-centered and egocentric, and I want to wish everybody a happy birthday, and I don't remember your names because I really wasn't paying that much attention to the names, but I do want to wish you a happy birthday, and thank you for Tasha for speaking before me. As I said earlier, I think my alcoholism what I was like before I took my first drink, because that's what we're supposed to talk about. You know, what I was like, not like what it was like, but what Mike was like. What happened and what Mike's like today as a result of Alcoholics Anonymous. And what I was like before I ever took my first drink, I grew up in a household of six of us. Four of us were alcoholics. My father died of alcoholism. December 13th, 1971, day after my birthday, he died drunk, a miserable, lonely, unhappy death. Alcoholism finally brought him down to his knees, and he finally died drunk. And he died alone, he died lonely, and he died with nothing, basically. He just died drunk. And he didn't have to die drunk, but he had too much pride to ask for help, and I kind of inherited some of that pride stuff. And you know, it was very difficult for me to ask another person for help. You know, alcoholics of my type don't specialize in asking for help. It's not, and it never has been, my natural inclination to reach out and say, you know, will you please help me? Because I'm the kind of guy that prefers to handle it all on his own. And I've been like that all my life, and I'm not sure if that's a belief or an old idea that was adopted way back when, but, I mean, I've always been like that. But the one thing that finally forced me to surrender, ask to help for help, was booze. You know, booze finally turned out to be the great persuader for me. And, I mean, I had a lot of other problems. I couldn't, you know, get along with people. I didn't mix well with the other kids. I didn't like myself. I had a kind of a cynical outlook on the world. I never felt like I was part of. I always felt less than. But I'll tell you something. That booze is the one thing that finally forced me to surrender and ask for help. And that's what happened to me June 24th of 85 in the San Diego County Jail. But when I was a kid, this household that I grew up in, the only thing I knew was fear. You know, and as I grew up, I knew two things, fear or flight. And I was the kind of guy that would be immobilized and terrorized with fear when I was a kid. And I don't know why I was like that. I just kind of like was full of anxiety and uptight all the time. And I didn't like being around my father, and he kind of intimidated me, and I was terrified of him, basically, because he was a drunk. And I was terrified of his unpredictable behavior, how his ragefulness and the way he kind of abused us in a strange kind of a way, the way he would spank us and discipline us. And I was just really terrified from him. And I'm not saying my father is what made me alcoholic. Drinking is what made me alcoholic. But there's something about my emotional and mental makeup that came from that kind of stuff when I grew up as a kid. And along those lines, the flip side of the coin is I always needed his approval. And I needed recognition, and I needed a pat on the back, and I needed all that stuff that any normal kid would want from a father, which is kind of a normal, you know, instinct that we all have to bond and to be part of something. And I never got that from my dad. So I grew up resenting him, hating him, full of fear. And as a result of not getting the attention that I kind of demanded, I developed a set of ideas like, you know, why is this like this? You know, why doesn't my dad want to hang out with me? And why doesn't he want to come and watch me play baseball and all these kinds of things? And so there must be something wrong with me. I mean, I must be some sort of misfit or something must be wrong because I never could quite figure out why that was. And somewhere along the line, I developed a belief. And they talk about in our literature, you know, that we have to let go of all of our old ideas. And I would say that the only idea I've ever really let go 100% beyond any shadow of a doubt is the idea that somehow, someday, Mike will find a way to control and enjoy his drink. And that idea has been 100% smashed. All the other ones are up for discussion. They still linger around. They still hang around. But the big idea, and I don't know if anybody can identify with this, that kind of ruled my life is that I'm not enough. That was the big one right there, that I'm just not enough. I mean, in every area of my life, the social instinct, the security, the sex, I just don't quite measure up. And I have proof of that, too. You know, like when I was in school, I couldn't get good grades, so therefore I used that as a way to support these beliefs. You know, like I'm not good enough, I'm not smart enough, I'm not going to be liked, I'm not going to be accepted. So I brought into this belief when I was a kid way before I ever took my first drink. I mean, they were like firmed in stone, these beliefs. And I remember my sponsor, the one that I had for 15 years, every time I would do an inventory, he would always ask me, what do you think the belief is behind it? What's the old idea? And I didn't even know anything about these beliefs till I was about 10 years sober, where I was able to finally start telling the truth about the beliefs, about all these old ideas, and the big one is the one I just got done telling you. And so as I'm growing up, before I ever took my first drink, I've got this fear and I've got all these old ideas, and I desperately need approval from other people, you know, and I was, you know, one of those people pleasers, not really so much because I wanted what you had, but I wanted your attention. And I wanted some approval and I wanted some recognition and I wanted you to basically notice me. And I don't think there's anything wrong with wanting that kind of stuff, except in my case, it's self-seeking and it's selfish because it's not a normal need or a want, it's a demand. And when they became demands is when I started having lots of problems with people, demanding more attention, demanding more protection, demanding more recognition than I deserve. And so I grew up with a lot of those old ideas and some of those demands as a result of that. 14 years old, like I said, my dad died from alcohol, and that's when I had my first drink. And as I told you, you know, the emotional mental makeup that I had when I was a kid, the anxiety, the fear, all the old ideas and all the stuff that was going on inside me, I knew that there was something not quite right with me, the way I felt and the way I thought. I mean, I just seen the world from a twisted, cynical, hateful perception of the world. I mean, that was my view of the world, and I was just terrified all the time. And my first drink of alcohol was at the age of 14 years old, and in the doctor's opinion, it talks about exactly what happens to a guy like me when I take a drink. It talks about that I'm restless, irritable, and discontent. Now, in my view, if there were ever any so-called relapse signs, that's it. Those got to be the three best relapse signs there are. And when I'm restless, irritable, and discontent, left unarmed with no higher power, no steps, no sponsor, no nothing, I'm going to drink. It's not a matter of if, it's really a matter of when in my particular case. So that's the way I was. When I read this description in the doctor's opinion, when they gave me this grave nature of alcoholism in this chapter, when I came across it, I knew that that was me. I mean, I've been restless, irritable, and discontent my entire life. And when I first took my first drink, it kind of made it all go away. It didn't really go away. I think what happened for me is it kind of changed the world that I lived in my own mind. It changed the view. It changed my perspective on life, people, the fear of the old. It all went away. And it did for me exactly what that big book said it did. It gave me a sense of ease and comfort. The problem with me is I always got too much of the stuff in me. Time after time, I'd get overserved, and I'd end up in strange predicaments and situations and a lot of unplanned events would happen throughout the course of a weekend's drinking. And that's the way it was with me. As it started out, it basically, I started out like a weekend warrior. It was like a Friday and Saturday night was a big deal for me. And I had such an ego that I had to have $50 in my pockets, plus a nice shiny car, because you know how important it is to look good. I mean, it's really important to get the attention of all the outside external things so they can somehow make me look good. And that's how I used other people and situations and things to feed my ego, because I had no self-esteem. As I told you before, I had no self-esteem at all. And so I had to have $50 in my pocket in a nice shiny car on a Friday night. And it started off like a weekend warrior. I didn't think there was any real big deal. I would drink, get drunk, have the dry heaves and throw up all day long. And I thought, well, this really isn't that big of a deal. You know, a few minor setbacks, but no real big deal here. Everybody goes through that. And I didn't really think of it was a real problem, because I had a unique way of bouncing back rather quickly, and quickly than most people for some strange reason. I don't know why that is. So that's what would happen. You know, I would drink and get drunk, and I'd stay out late, and I wouldn't come home, and I wouldn't call, and the wife would be wondering, where is he? He hasn't called. Is he in a hospital? Is he dead? And see, I never considered that stuff at all. The selfishness of my alcoholism runs so deep that I never even considered what she might have been going through, the fear, the worry, is he in jail? I never considered that at all. And I have to tell you, to this very day, I would like to think I know to the depths of the pain and the misery that I created people in my life, but I really don't. I really don't. And I think that's really the truth. I really don't know how much misery and pain that I caused my family at all. I mean, I'd like to think I know to satisfy my ego, but I really don't. And I don't think I ever will know. And so what I did was I joined the Navy when I was 17 years old and drank myself out of a career. 17 years old, I was already a full-blown alcoholic and didn't even know it, man. I did not know it. I just knew that I loved to drink, and that's the only thing that mattered to me. Slowly but surely, alcoholism was, I was leading to the grips of a progressive fatal illness and didn't know it. And it was the most important thing in my life, drinking. And I'd go out and get drunk on leave or on a weekend, and I'd be out all night. And this is what I would tell myself all week long. I'm never going to do that again. I'm done with that forever, never, ever again am I going back out there to drink. Well, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, guess where I was? Right down there on that strip in North Fork, Virginia, drinking one more time. And that's the way it was. They kicked me out of the Navy. I got a job, and I had no ambition. I had no education. I'm just like trying to move through life as best I can with no real direction. I mean, that's kind of summarizes who I was when I was drinking, with no direction, no ambition, no goals. Let's just move through life as best we can, but we have to keep our priorities in perspective when that's about drinking. And that's the way it was. I met a girl when I was about 18 years old, right out of the Navy, and I had such low self-esteem. You know, I don't know about you guys, but when I would drink, I would lie a lot, too. I did that quite a bit. And I would paint an image, and I would want you to see something that I'm not, because, I mean, that's all about lying as well. And so I did all that stuff and got married to that girl. Stayed married for 9 years, and 9 years of nothing, basically, but misery. I mean, I was there physically, but I really wasn't there emotionally or mentally at all for this woman. It was really all about me all the time. And I would get drunk and come home sometimes and scream and put my fist through the wall and abuse my kids physically, my son. There's some of the things that I would do. I carried a lot of guilt and remorse about that. We have a step that cleans that up as well. And so that's the way it was. And she stayed married to me for 9 years until she had enough. And what happened was that she decided to leave me for my best friend. What was the best thing that she could have ever done for us? I mean, I was not present for her at all in any shape, form, or fashion with this woman at all. And at that point in time, throughout the marriage, I'm starting to get these 502s, and I'm starting to end up in jail, and I never really thought I would ever get that bad, or I would drink and lose control, and I would end up in jail. And 1981, I got locked up for a series of drunk driving tickets. I had three of them. I got two more later on, but I had three, and so they locked me up. And what happened when I got locked up, I don't know about anybody else, but I always was very humble when my freedom was taken away from me. I was always ready to change and be a good guy and never drink again and be a productive member of society. And I really thought that I could live up to that. I really thought that I could, if I just make a decision to not drink no matter what, that I can do this thing on my own if I really, really want to. Well, the track record proved that I can't, and I never could. See, I'm not one of those guys who can just not drink no matter what. I'm powerless over alcohol. What that means to me, that left on my own, there's no way that I'm going to stay sober for any period of time. I'm going to drink again, left on through my own resources. There's just no possible way I can do this on my own. And so 1981, I come out of jail, and I'm trying to be a good guy, and it lasted for about 3 or 4 days, and it came time to drink. And I drank again. I was off and running, and she finally decided to get rid of me. It's like, you know, the thumb, get out the door, you're done. I'm through with you. And two more years of drinking was my worst. I got to the point in my life that I had, like, this emptiness on the inside of me. And the loneliness and the despair and the remorse and the fear. And from time to time, I would get brief moments of clarity about how bad things really are with my drinking. And, you know, and I was going through this divorce and you know, she's leaving me and my best friend's moving in and big time resentment and self-pity and hate and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, you have to show them. You can't just sit there and take that, you know, you can't take that lying down. And so what I did was, is I went out and I tried to commit suicide a couple of times, you know, just to show her, to let her know that I'm really a good guy and she's making a big mistake here leaving me for this guy. And I made a couple of attempts, one serious attempt, and I'll never forget what happened when I came out. I ended up in a coma on a respirator for 3 days. And I came out of this coma, and there's people in AA like this that I'm getting ready to describe, and I would tell anybody to avoid these kind of people for as long as you possibly can until you get desperate enough to ask for help. And I came out of this coma, and there was a psychiatrist, like, standing above me, and he asked me one question. He says, "What would it take to make you happy?" And all I could say to him, this is how far out of it and how, you know, they say we can't differentiate the truth from the false in the doctor's opinion, and I couldn't. I didn't know what the truth was, if it hit me in the face about my alcoholism. And I said, "All I want is my wife back." And he looked right at me and he says, "That won't make you happy." And he turned around and he walked off. Now, I'm sitting there on my deathbed looking for a little help here. You know, I'm looking for this guy to try to maybe to get us back together and have some counseling sessions so I can get my way, which is what I want, which is me about me getting my way. And he looked right at me and he turned around and he walked out and he said, "That won't make you happy, man." And I sure didn't like hearing that because he's seen right through me. And that's what I mean about some of the people in AA. I had a sponsor for 15 years that seen right through me before I even lied. And these kind of guys have a way of pulling your covers, at least they did for me. And they kind of forced me to tell the truth when I didn't really want to tell the truth at all. And so that's the way that this guy was. And so I went out, you know, so I had to continue showing her, you know, and kind of a mistake she's making leaving a good guy like me and all this kind of stuff. And I continued to drink for another couple of years. And my alcoholism had gotten so bad that I was doing things like, you know, in and out of county mental health systems numerous times. You know, the state of California, when you get drunk out of your mind and do some of the things that I would do, like,
tear things up and destructive and self-destructive, and they put you in jail, and they start evaluating you and trying to figure out, you know, why are you acting like this? What's wrong with you? And these psychiatrists would talk to me, and I would lie to them. I would talk about what she's doing to me, and she's leaving me for my best friend, and I'm a father. I mean, just a big victim role, you know, and that's part of my dishonesty is playing a victim. I mean, you know, if I'm a victim, then I can get all your attention and all your validation, a little pat on the back and a hug every now and again and say, you know, everything's going to be okay. Just don't worry about it. I had one big fear with these guys, and they were going to discover my big secret, which is I like to drink a lot. I didn't want them knowing that. And so I had to lie all the time about what the real problem was. So, of course, you know, I'm confronted with alcoholism and I'm still drinking and going to jail and going to CMH. And what happened with me is I ended up getting two more drunk driving tickets, a couple of more suicide attempts. And I get locked up in the San Diego County Jail June 24th of 85. And this is when God started working in my life, I believe. And I really believe when I finally surrendered to the fact that I have a disease, a fatal illness that's going to kill me. When I finally surrendered that I am bodily and mentally different from my fellows, that I'm afflicted with an illness, that there's no human solution to it, that there's no possible way that I'm going to be able to keep me sober on my own for long. I mean, on my own, I probably have about 3 days worth of willpower. That's about it. It's like, how long do you think you can hold your breath underwater? I mean, I got about 60 seconds worth. Somebody may be able to do it for 2 whole minutes, but the one thing that's going to happen, eventually it's going to run out. And when it runs out, that's the end. And that's the way it was for me, trying to stay sober through my own resources, which is, when I say my own resources, it's about $50, pride, ego, self-reliance. She, it, they somehow are going to do it because I can't do it on my own. There's no possible way I can do it. And so, while I'm in the San Diego County Jail, I got booked in there, and from that point on, I believed that I was getting perfect help. And what I mean by perfect help, I'm not talking about like a perfect life of sobriety. I'm talking about God's help shows up absolutely at perfect timing. And that's the way it happened for me. And I think it was out of an absolute total surrender to the first step. 100%. Before, I was in and out of AA, and I wasn't 100% hopeless case. I was like partially powerless, almost 100%. I wasn't really quite convinced. So I needed 2 more years of destructive drinking, 2 more years of suicide attempts, 2 more years of loneliness, despair, as it says here in Bill's story, 2 more years of destructive drinking, getting me closer and closer to an alcoholic death, and I can't stop. I'm absolutely 100% out of control, and I knew it. So what happened was is I got confronted with this problem, which was my drinking was about to kill me, and I was sentenced to go to this work furlough center, and this is how God started working in my life. As I'm sitting in work furlough, they do a physical, and they seen that I had a surgery in 1984, a year before I sobered up. And they told me, this nurse told me, you can't stay here. Well, the next place is like work is honor camp. You know, because I've been to work furlough before. I thought, well, I'll just go to honor camp. Well, God had other plans for Mike. I wasn't getting out of this one. I wasn't going to talk my way out of this. I wasn't going to lie. I wasn't going to manipulate, control. I mean, I'm like in a corner and there's no way out. And that's exactly where I needed to be. In a corner of a wall with no way out except being forced to ask for help. And what happened with me is I ended up going to the San Diego County Jail for like 100 days. The old county jail, the one downtown San Diego. Not the new one, but the old one. And that's where I went. My first 90 days, I stayed there for about 100 days. And what happened was, and I didn't know it, and I think my surrender was kind of a strange kind of subconscious surrender. I wasn't even sure I'd done it until I'd been sober in this place called Pathfinders for about 6 months straight out of the county jail. And I'll tell you about that in a minute. So while I'm in the county jail, I'm praying my butt off every day. You know, I'm waking up at all hours of the night, having these drunk dreams, which is pretty normal when you're a newcomer, and to have these drinking dreams. And I would wake up at all hours of the night sometimes throughout the week, and I would say, thank God, after I finally came to and realized where I was, thank God I'm here in jail. I mean, that's how you know, how far down the scale I'd went. Thank God I'm locked up in jail, you know. And I don't think any normal drinker would think along those lines, but that's where I was at. And what happened was there was a lady that would come up to the sixth floor. I was in the psychiatric unit, you know, by the way, the PSU department. I don't know why they put a well-adjusted human being like me in a place like that. But that's where I was, in the psychiatric unit on the sixth floor. And this lady used to come up every Sunday morning, and she would have the big book. And she was in H&I. And she would have a meeting, her and I would have a meeting, and we'd sit down and we'd talk, we'd share our story with each other. I didn't even know what this thing was. I didn't know anything about a recovery home. I knew about AA, you know. I wasn't quite desperate enough for that yet. I hadn't gone that far down the scale yet to ask for help there. I mean, that's like the bottom of the barrel. But I knew that I was an alcoholic and that my life had become unmanageable. And what she said was, would you like to go to a recovery home? I said, why not? Where else am I going to go? So the minute those doors opened up, I went to a place called Pathfinders in San Diego. A lot of you guys know about that place. It's been there. And God had started working in my life because I had finally surrendered and didn't know it. I really didn't know it. And I'll tell you how I finally, something was strange, because when I got in that place, and I was like 4 months sober, maybe 5 months sober, and there was something different on the inside of me the way I felt. I couldn't explain it. I couldn't put my finger on it. I just knew something. I felt like I was cleansed. I felt like I was brand new on the inside, and I hadn't even looked at the big book. I hadn't even taken the steps. I hadn't done anything. I'm just fresh out of the county jail. And this is the honest God's truth, and I couldn't quite figure out what that was. I felt like I was like a kid. And what I finally found out what that was is I had surrendered 100% to the fact that I have a disease, a fatal illness, a progressive fatal illness that's killing me. And I'd finally surrendered it to a power greater than myself. And I didn't even know I'd done that until I was in that. And I used to wonder what that was, and it took me several years in the program to finally come to grips with what that was about. And that was about total surrender. And so what it was with me, and this is on page 8 in Bill's story, and this is kind of where I found myself. Trembling, I stepped from the hospital, a broken man. Fear sobered me. Oh, that's it. This is above that. No words could tell the loneliness, despair I found in that bitter morass of self-pity. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I had met my match. I had been overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master. And that was true in my case, man. Alcohol was my master. Now, I know that not drinking part is a little underrated from time to time in meetings, but I really think it's important to mention in a meeting of AA that not drinking part, at least I think so in my particular case. I've got a problem with alcohol. I don't not have a problem with alcohol. That's what forced me to surrender, is my problem with alcohol. I got a lot of other problems. You know, the big book talks about the spiritual malady, but they don't even start talking about that until you get into chapter right there in the inventory. So there's like 60 pages dedicated in this big book of Alcoholics Anonymous to get me convinced that I am powerless over alcohol and my life has become unmanageable. You know, and that kind of laid the groundwork for me. So what I did was, is as a result of being convinced of the true nature of my condition, I finally walked up to a guy and asked for help. I said, how do you do this thing? You guys are talking about not drinking and you seem to be reasonably happy and content. How do you do this? So, and they basically got me to the big book, and they said, read this thing, and when it says to do something, you just do it. And that's really what I did. I mean, it's not like I was like a copycat. I copied a lot of people that came before me. And I took the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous as written in this big book. And all I can tell you is the obsession to drink was removed. Completely, 100% removed. And it has never returned since I've gotten sober, since I asked for help. Not one single time have I ever thought that it might be different this time and drink. Not once. So I get the sponsor and I'm doing the steps, and 5-6 years into my sobriety, I go through a divorce. Later on in my sobriety, as time's moving along through the divorce, I didn't know anything about meditation, the 11th step, and I started learning how to meditate at about 5 or 6 years sober, not out of any virtue, but because it's like I needed some extra help. I mean, I'm doing the inventory, reading it off to my sponsor, and as time's moving along, I need something else, and so I started to learn how to meditate when I was about 5-6 years sober, and I've been using it ever since. I've done some, you know, exploring and looking at some different things, but I learned how to meditate when I was about 6 years sober. Went through the divorce and was a single parent for 10 years in AA. I had jobs, got fired from jobs. I've had more adversity in Alcoholics Anonymous in my sobriety than I ever had when I was drinking. A lot more adversity. And I have found out that the adversity in my particular case is a good thing for a guy like me, because it kind of has a way of humbling me and asking for help. It forces me to reach out one more time to a higher power. And so I've went through a lot of that stuff in sobriety, serious health issues. Tasha was talking about her son going off in Iraq and Afghanistan. The hardest thing that I went through last year was my son going to Afghanistan. And me and her used to talk about it all the time. I learned a whole new meaning of surrender when I went through that. I was kind of forced one more time to look within and do more inventory and read it off and pray and get on my knees and just say, "Dear God, please keep my son safe," you know. I mean, I had to, because I can't control this. You know, I can't, there's nothing I can do about him over there. I can't fix it like I would like to. And so it's amazing to me that the pain and the adversities looks like a bad thing, gleep, dim, depressing thing, as it turns out to be more of an asset in my sobriety, because I grew spiritually with this meditation and learning, you know, like this is really God's deal. This is like out of my hands. I got to give him to God. And he came back safe, and I thank God for that. It's just an amazing deal. I get married to a young lady here, and we've been married for 14, 15 years. I've started my own business. I'm so blessed in so many areas of my life. I would feel guilty if I told you how blessed I am, and I count my blessings every single day, because I know without Alcoholics Anonymous and a power greater than myself, I would not have a prayer being sober and have the blessings I have. I mean, my sobriety is a gift. It is a gift. I have to do the work, but it's a gift from the results of the work. And I just love being sober. I've never had it so good. I really have never had it so good. You know, we've been married for 14 years, and we have our ups and downs. We're human, you know, we're not perfect. And we get to learn from our shortcomings and our defects of character through inventory and prayer and meditation and making amends and all this kind of stuff. And Alcoholics Anonymous has shown me how to live life sober and to be reasonably happy at the same time. You know, and I have a relationship with a power greater than myself. I didn't think that would be possible for a guy like me. And I know that the core, my spiritual objective for me, and I'm only speaking for me, is lined out on page 55 in this big book, where it talks about that deep down in every man, woman, and child, there's a fundamental idea of God. I mean, I got some kind of core belief about God. And the whole goal for me is to continue to keep stuff removed that blocks me from God, like resentment and fear and judgment and all these defects of character block me from God. And that's about my will. And to keep as much of this stuff removed so I can be in touch with that. Because to me, that's the whole goal, is this relationship with a power greater than myself. Because without that, there's no way that I would be sober and have a life, you know. And working with others has been a big part of my sobriety too. And I do H&I. I'll say this and I'll sit down. I believe my sobriety is a gift. And the way I show God gratitude for the gift he's given me is by service work. I mean, that's the highest rank I will ever make in AA as a servant. And if I think I'm anything above that, I'm in deep trouble. If I go along the lines thinking I'm something special, you know, I got divinely appointed sponsors and all this kind of stuff, I'm in deep, deep trouble, man. Because that's not it. It's just one drunk working with another. And Alcoholics Anonymous is by far the best thing that's ever happened to me in my entire life. And I'm just really happy to be here. And I want to thank Larry again for asking me to talk.